Hello everyone and welcome to Shedcast number 8, an episode which I have really looked forward to writing for a long time, as I think I trailed in the last episode, to be honest. Just a note that for this topic I ended up writing rather a lot, so you will have found two episodes in the feed, 8A and 8B, just to break it up a bit and give you a bit more time for reflection between the two. Our question in these episodes is to arrive at a conclusion. Can medieval England, in let's say 1500, be described as a nation in the historian's understanding of that word? Let me start with a story. You are standing outside the walls of many-towered Ilium, the most magnificent city in the ancient world, otherwise known as Troy. But after 10 years of ceaseless warfare and siege, fair Ilium is fair no longer. Ilium is burning. And the red flames rage around her towers and white walls and an odd, enormous wooden horse. Everywhere is screaming and blood and flames reflected in shining bronze armour as the Achaeans, thirsty for honour, supremacy, trade and a little matter of Helen, put Troy to the sword after 10 years of struggle. If we look into the mighty palace of Priam, the aged king of Troy, we see more horrors. The son of Achilles, Neoptolemus, is burning to revenge his father's death from Paris's treacherous poison. And he sees Priam's young son, Polites, and shoots an arrow catching him in the leg. But Polites manages to hobble away and escape and make it to his father's palace, where he desperately seeks the protection of Zeus at the altar. But the powerful Neoptolemus bursts in and in front of the eyes of his horrified father, the young warrior butchers Polites, ignoring his pleas for mercy. Furiously, helplessly, the old man heaves a spear, but Neoptolemus brushes it aside, seizes the king, drags him to the same altar, and butchers him in turn. As atrocities rage throughout the city, a small group escapes, seemingly unnoticed. They were led by a man called Aeneas, and the Danaans fail to notice him because the protection of the gods, Aphrodite and Apollo, are around them. Aeneas' family is destined to found a new Troy, a golden city whose name would be known to millions through the ages as the Immortal City. I speak, of course, of Loughborough. Ha, jokes. Loughborough is a small town in the East Midlands. I speak, of course, of Rome. Now, I imagine you are wondering why I'm telling you all of this. Well, obviously, it's because I want an excuse to warble on about the Iliad and the Aeneid. But listen on, and I promise I will make it relevant. Not sure how, right now, but I'll come good. Aeneas has a son called Silvius, as you do, and Silvius then has a son called Brutus. Brutus came with a number of unfortunate prophecies attached to his name, and duly fulfills them, including shooting his father with an arrow. Oops. And he is therefore cast out from Italy, and with his followers makes his way to a place called Totnes. Totnes is a jolly nice place. And if Totnes had landed there today, he'd have booked himself into a very nice B&B, I'm sure. So I mean no disrespect to Totnes, but it's a slightly incongruous place for the father of the entirety of British history to start. But anyway, gentle listeners, that is in fact where it all started, the history of Britain. Or at least it was to a man called Geoffrey of Monmouth, author of one of the most influential books in British history and literature, The History of the Kings of Britain. We can let Geoffrey take it from here, heavily edited, because Geoffrey does go on a bit, it has to be said. At this time, the island of Britain was called Albion. It was most attractive, and it filled Brutus and his comrades with a great desire to live there. They began to cultivate the fields and to build houses, so that in a short time you would have thought the land had always been inhabited. Brutus then called the island Britain, after his own name, and his companions he called Britons. Corineus, this is David here, sorry to break in, Jeff. Corineus, by the way, was a mighty warrior and companion of Brutus. Sorry, Jeff, take it away, dude. As I was saying, Corineus called the region of the kingdom which had fallen to his share Cornwall, and the people who lived there he called Cornishmen. Corineus experienced great pleasure from wrestling with the giants. Ah, sorry to break in again, Jeff, but we haven't got all day, you know. These good people have got lives to lead. Let's skip to the dividing of the kingdom bit, shall we? As we agreed? Or no pies, okay? Ah, okay, let me see now. Ah, yes, here we are. In the meantime, Brutus had consummated his marriage with his wife Inuga, running his strong hands over her knobbly Jeff. Here we are. By her, he had three sons, called Locrinus, Camber, and Albanactus. When their father finally died, they divided the kingdom of Britain between them in such a way that each succeeded to Britain in one particular district. Locrinus, who was firstborn, inherited the part of the island which was afterwards called Logria, after him. Camber received the region which is on the further bank of the River Severn, now known as Wales. Albanactus too, the region now known as Scotland, he called it Albany, after his name. Just to clarify, here then is what medieval Englishmen thought of as their creation story. The creation of England, originally called Logria, Wales, originally called Cambria, and Scotland, originally called Albany. The only one of the three names that has survived with any modern memory. There is deep irony in the tale. Geoffrey of Monmouth was a Welshman. Let Welshmen remember their glorious past, the narrative cries at one point, because although Geoffrey sucked at the teat of English success and wealth in Oxford, he of course hankered after his homeland and despised the Saxon invader, as you do. But despite this, the English did what they are so very perfidiously good at. They nicked the whole thing. Henry II started it all, claiming to discover the burial place of the legendary Arthur, but it was Edward I who really did the deed, during the Scottish Wars of Independence. Both sides at one point put their case to the Pope for why they should be the overlord of Scotland. Edward breezily based his claim on Geoffrey's history, claiming that Britain had originally been one place. English kings had always been the heir of Brutus, and therefore QED, the kings of England, was the overlord of the Scots, or Albanians, if you like. The Scots did point out that there was a bit of a leap there. At what point exactly had it been demonstrated that the kings of England had always been overlords of that one kingdom? But hate it or loathe it, and the Welsh and the Scots choose both options, of course, the light-fingered English had done exactly what they do with international cricket players. They'd half-inched it and made it their own. Hopefully you're enjoying England's creation story, but you're probably still wondering why on earth I'm telling you all of this. And it is, I have to admit, a rather weak answer. But it is that in returning to our question for the day, could a medieval England in 1500 be described as a nation? There's little doubt that by 1500, if you stopped most English men and women in the street, once they'd wiped the poo off their feet, they would be able to tell you this creation story with a shared sense of pride and ownership. The English knew where they came from. The fact that it was all hogwash, of course, is irrelevant. They weren't to know that. And yet, describe medieval England as a nation to any modern historian, that is, a historian of the modern world, and you're likely to get one of three responses. A patronising, pitying smile that will make you feel like pulling your nails down a blackboard. A guffaw of laughter and disdain. Or a boot in your backside as you're propelled out of the door. None of these responses, you might notice, are very positive. As I related at the start of the last episode, I despair, and have despaired for years. To my simple mind, of course England is a nation, certainly by 1500, probably a lot earlier. After all, let me remind you of the 12th century chronicler William of Malmesbury, who wrote of the Norman Conquest. We have experienced the truth of this prophecy, for England has become the habitation of outsiders and the dominion of foreigners. Today no Englishman is earl, bishop or abbot, and newcomers gnaw away at the riches and very innards of England, nor is there any hope for an end of this misery. Now that sounds like a patriotic Englishman to me, quod erat demonstratus, sic biscuitus disintegrat, Brutus ate some yam and all of that. If I had drawn the short straw and got the pitying smile historian, I would now be given a lesson about what it means to claim to be a nation and why medieval England does not qualify. So hopefully you can imagine my most condescending of smiles as we go through them. If you are so imagining, I'm not sure you're going to make it to the end. Pretty good at the condescending thing, truthfully. Really, you have to start with the definition of what nationalism is, or at least how it has been defined by the modernist, the historian of the modern world. And because it's enormously fun, when we've done that and looked at why the medieval world doesn't hack it, We'll have a bit of a wander through the historiography of it all, because that is also a hoot. So what we're going to do for the rest of this episode is to talk about the original theory of what nationalism meant, then look at how modern historians have begun to reinterpret them in the light of the disasters of the 20th century, and actually as a reaction to Whig English Victorian historians. And we'll end up with some of the views of English historians recently about where English historians have identified the start of an England that could declare itself a nation. Okay, in the next episode, we'll actually look at the evidence for national consciousness in England. Okey-dokey, onward. So, there are more descriptions of the qualifications needed to be a nation-state by more historians than flies on the oft-mentioned pile of proverbial. But we are going to go to one Jean Breuil. Terribly French name, not actually sure he's French, might be from Sheffield. But here's what he says is required for a state to be described as a nation. There exists an explicit and peculiar character. The interests and values of the nation take priority over other interests and values. The nation must always be as independent as possible. This usually requires the attainment of political sovereignty. Okay, so let's have that again, and in fact you might want to write it on the back of your hand or something, or the back of the dog you're walking, or the bum you're following if you're cycling, whatever. Because we'll need to keep referring back. So, that is three things. Number one, the nation has an explicit and peculiar character. You can spot an Englishman or a Frenchman or a Dane or whatever it might be. Number two, the interests and values of the nation take priority. That's an interesting one, sort of Horace type thing. Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, all that sort of stuff. And number three, it's an independent nation. Now, against that definition, my friendly modernist historian would make a few pithy comments. Medieval Europe, she might say, defined itself as Christendom, a supranational organisation which by definition prevents any medieval state from being fully independent and therefore from being called a nation. Think that was me being a female medieval historian. Not quite sure. Not until the Reformation can we really begin to think about the death of Christendom, of that idea. But that's not all. Oh, dearie me, no, that's not all at all. Then there's the political community. Modernists would laugh in the face of the coherence of the medieval political community. Look, they'd say, there are really no proper representative organisations. The only engagement you've got is with the top 5% of the population. Actually, you've not got a barney about what the mass of people are thinking. All they probably care about is where the next pint of ale is coming from. And while we're on that, it'd lead them to the regional thing. They'd point to France, for example, and talk about the strength of the region. The south of France, for example, is almost a completely different country to the north, the Languedoc and the Languedoc. Interesting fact, remind me to come back to that when I finish this thought. And of course, they'd go potty when it came to the patchwork of German principalities. Where's Germany? They'd say. There are over 300 Germanists as far as I can see. They're like rabbits. No, 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 no. Medieval societies, for the main part, are regional, not national. The local lord, parish, king. Relationships are personal, not formal, national, political. And so the battle lines are drawn. The objections to the idea of medieval England being a nation are, number one, the supranational loyalties to Christendom. Number two, the regionalism of medieval society. Number three, the lack of wider political engagement. And then also the personal dynastic power structure. So actually, that's a trilogy in four parts, isn't it? One more time, supranational loyalties to Christendom, regionalism, the lack of wider political engagement, and personal dynastic power structures. Let us now look at the historiography, because as I say, that is in itself quite a story. The story of a great idea in nationalism that was actually supposed to liberate the world and end in world peace, and turned out really very differently. Before I do, that interesting fact. Did you know the Languedoc and Languedoc thing? So you might know that the south of France is often called the Languedoc, and the word literally means the place with the language of Oc. Oc being the way, once upon a time, the people there pronounced the word hui. Meanwhile, the north of France used to be the Languedoc, because up there that's how they pronounced the word for yes. The thing is spookily similar to England, with Bede's Northumbrians and Southumbrians, and to the standardisation of language. In England from the 15th century, of course, language gets more and more standardised about what is called Chancery English from the central documents produced by the government, just as the Languedoc becomes the French standard. Anyway, I digress. So, one of the fundamental problems which has probably led to my years of frustration and lack of understanding is quite simply a problem of definition. Nationalism with a little n and nationalism with a big N sort of thing. Nationalism has become so ingrained in our language that we just take it for granted and use it to describe anything, from pride and patriotism to rabid, tub-thumping, aggressive, imperialistic, war-hungry desires for global domination, rather like Plankton in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie, to use a totally safe, if slightly odd, example. Maybe Hitler would have been a better example, if a bit more dangerous. But in fact, of course, as I'm sure you are well aware, nationalism was originally a specific political philosophy. And the reason I mentioned the likes of Immanuel Kant, who was one of the first folks to argue that universal peace would be achieved through universal democracy and international cooperation. Because the really rather heartbreaking thing is that nationalism was supposed to solve all our problems, not including those personal things I'm not allowed to talk about, but all our problems of international violence and difference. The idea was that once all the peoples of the world were aligned and given proper expression in open societies organised into coherent nations that reflected their shared racial, linguistic and cultural characteristics, with open political expression, there'd be no reason to fight for territory and supremacy, because we'd all have what we'd been fighting for all this time. Ring the bells of truth, light and justice. When Woodrow Wilson came to the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, he came with that hope, and indeed expectation, in his pocket, that once all those people were set free, there would be a perfect peace. Instead, as we know, the Treaty of Versailles was one of the most disastrous treaties ever, though not purely because of the nationalism thing, but that was an element, hate it or loathe it. How sad is that? As Bernard of Clairvaux had it, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Well, I think he actually said hell is full of good wishes, but it's been improved. Very broadly, there seem to have been two roads to this particular hell, being specifically the view that nations are the most natural and effective form of human association and political organisation. The bringing together of people into each nation who share political, territorial, cultural, ethnic characteristics to form an independent, self-conscious nation-state. The first road to this nirvana was that people would actively make a decision to get together into these nation-states. It's a French thing, a strong coffee and Gauloise thing developed by Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the other figures of the Enlightenment in the 18th century. They would form this nation-state because there were these citizens who would find freedom and security and autonomy. I weep for the rationalism and optimism of it all. The second road was a much more emotional one, the heart rather than the head, and it came out of German Romanticism and a chap called Johann Gottfried Herder, another 18th century philosophical type, more fresh-faced than those Gauloise-puffing French blokes. Herder was a fiercely patriotic German who was gutted at the disunity of the German people and advanced the importance of language in a nation. The view that developed was that becoming a nation-state would be a much more involuntary process. Like iron filings to the magnet, nations would form based on culture, race and language. Sadly, this became much more biological as time went by, and it's from this route that the more rabid forms of racialism and racial characteristics forms, which lead to the triumph of National Socialism in Germany in 1933, and so on and so forth. Of course, all the pain and agony that flowed, and indeed still flows, from that acid has affected historians and their view of nationalism. Suddenly no one is quite so keen, or certainly amongst the tea-drinking, floral-dressing, open-toed sandal community they're not. And so we have other interpretations of nationalism and its origin. In 1960, Kaddouri wrote about Arab nationalism and wrote baldly that, quote, nationalism is a doctrine invented in Europe at the beginning of the 19th century. So, no global flowering of natural forces there then. Others were reinterpreting the old theories differently as well. Marxists and political scientists took a combative view, hardly surprising for Marxists to take a combative view after all, that really, all this fresh-faced stuff about the pursuit of truth, light, justice and peace was clearly not something the old world was capable of. No. Nationalism was invented. It was invented for nefarious reasons by the forces of industrialisation and capitalism. At which point, at least one of my very own will pump the air and declare the need and immediate intention to seize the means of production. But the theory goes that governments and capitalists used mass communication and education to promote the idea of a corporate national identity in the 18th and 19th century for their own nefarious means. This theory, of course, is completely inconsistent with any idea of medieval nation-states, given the state of industry and bureaucracy at the time. It's an interesting perspective, and the Marxist view is always fun. It reduces those things like language, culture, and race into handy tools for the manipulator, i.e. the capitalists or governments, rather than the natural factors around which a people gathers. Another more recent bloke to mention is Benedict Anderson. He uses a rather handy description for a nation as a, quote, imagined political community. Imagined political community. I did see someone on Facebook saying they'd read this particular thesis and found it to be an example of why say something in 100 words when you could say it in about a million. But, imagined political community. Interesting. Essentially, if you all convince yourself that you are a nation, then a nation you shall be, on the proviso that you inhabit a defined territory and political system. In this idiom, our shared cultural heritage is essential. The English had their own creation story, and as long as this was widely accepted and understood, Brutus and Arthur were powerful ways of giving people a shared sense of community. Based on something which, as we know, was very much imagined, rather than being real. But it doesn't have to be real, as long as people believe it. Anderson saw the genesis of nationalism as being in the 16th century, particularly because of the arrival of Protestantism and the end of one holy apostolic and Catholic Church, the end of this supranational organisation of Christendom. Others like to point the finger at the French Revolution in 1789 as where it all started. Essentially, at a history conference, no historians of modern history will put their hands up and mention Alfred the Great and the idea of the Angelkuchen as the start of nationalism. If they did, they would have been the most horrendous, shuffling of feet, coughing, eye-rolling, tittering, and embarrassed glances. So, where have we got to? We are discussing the way in which nationalism as a concept has been interpreted, how those original French and German movements have been reinterpreted by later historians, and therefore how modern historians define nationalism with a big N, and that the impetus to change definition came about because of the disasters of the 20th century and its two world wars, which rather knackered the original idea of peace, light, and the rest of it. But these new interpretations were not just reactions to the nationalist nightmares of the 20th century. They were also, in England at least, a reaction to the Victorian historian and the Whig approach to history. By now, the thing about Whiggish history is a well-trodden path, I think, for the history of Englanders, but let us look at the Whigs in this particular context and their interpretation of the growth of the English nation. Because with the growth of English national consciousness, we are at the absolute sweet spot of what those Victorians were all about. Here was their chance to celebrate the glory of English society and England, an opportunity that made them dribble. This was where they could explain why this small, damp, muddy island had created an empire that covered a fair proportion of the known world. By the way, I am super conscious of just how irritating that is, the small, damp, blah, blah, empire thing. I saw a lovely review, I think, from an Irish person on a different podcast, essentially saying, if we have to hear this story again, I'm going to eat my liver sort of thing that made me laugh a lot. But sorry, no way around it here. So, we are talking about some grand old names of British history here. William Stubbs has been mentioned many times before on this podcast series. But then there's Thomas Babington Macaulay, politician and historian, who I now find out was born at Rothley Temple, Leicestershire, which is now a hotel where I used to wash dishes and squish molehills for £1 an hour. How did I not know this back then? And then there's G.M. Trevelyan, a historian who I once made the mistake of quoting in an A-level essay. Oh, I was burnt, I can tell you, I was burnt. These are the grand old men of Whig history. It's all there. Parliament, common law, the English constitution, which according to Macaulay was, quote, the best under which any great society has ever yet existed. So he likes it then. All of this raised England into a different sphere of development from continental Europe. The Whigs emphasised continuity, a sort of almost seamless linear march through history with the banners of excellence and empire held high from the Anglo-Saxons to the modern day. They argued about stuff. So, for example, was Parliament a descendant of the Witan? Was the impact of the Norman conquest a temporary aberration, or actually did it bring sterling values of Norman efficiency and discipline to the touchy-feely and emotional Anglo-Saxons? Norman beer, Anglo-Saxon ale sort of thing. They decided that the march of history hadn't been entirely straight. The 14th and 15th centuries in particular got a very bad press, as you might remember from the rather harsh treatment of Edward III at the hand of old Stubbsy. But then the march resumed with the break from Rome, Elizabethan government, and the parliaments of the 17th century finished the job off. National characteristics get all mixed into it, until you get perilously close to the white man's burden thing and the supremacy of the Anglo-Saxon. Obviously, many of these guys were stunning historians who were far too accomplished to suffer at my feeble hands, but all historians, medieval or otherwise, have run away as hard as they can from this deeply unfashionable approach to history. Amongst other reasons, because often there is too obvious an attempt to squeeze the facts to fit the favoured theory. But also because the national characteristics type of thing was completely discredited by the horrors of the 20th century nationalism and two world wars. And in fact, therefore, English historians have overreacted. There's a nice quote from a historian I've always loved to read, G.W.S. Barrow, in 1980. Here we go. The last two generations of medieval scholars have been so anxious to correct the false romanticism of the 19th century that the very idea of nationalism in the Middle Ages has become one of our most rigidly observed taboos. Essentially, what Barrow is saying is that if you believed in medieval nationalism, you are now ideologically suspect. Ugh. Of course, the most dangerous element in all of this was a race, and the idea that a racial group was necessarily a nation or candidate for nationhood hit the back of a bin with a resounding clang. And medievalists would still these days refuse to necessarily draw straight lines from medieval kingdoms to modern nations and nationalism, which seems reasonable in many cases such as Germany, Italy, Netherlands, Belgium, and so on. But it seems a little doctrinaire when applied to France, Spain and England, when really you can see that link pretty clearly. But I'm most definitely not an expert. Now, the aforementioned Benedict Anderson, with his definition of nations as imagined political communities, was not a fan of the idea of medieval nationalism. But his definitions have freed things up a bit, because it has allowed the discussion of groups and communities based on things other than race. And now that people use the word ethnicity, people feel a bit happier talking about all that as well. Plus, medievalists decided that it was time to stop trying to make historians of modern history feel happy, which is a good thing, because that wasn't happening anyway. Instead of trying to make medieval kingdoms meet the criteria for modern nationalism, why don't we instead step past that whole arid debate and simply ask the question, how far did national sentiment and feeling impact on the lives of medieval folk? It doesn't need to be a binary thing. You either are nationalist or you aren't. We can just accept that nationalism with a big N is a modern thing. Nationalism with a little N is what we'll look for in the Middle Ages. And so the constipation mentioned by G.W.S. Barrow has hopefully finally been cured. Sorry about the constipation thing. My mother could not get through a whole day without mention of milk of magnesia or constipation, so it's difficult to avoid. I've done pretty well over 205 episodes. Which brings us to the historiography of the debate about the appearance of English nationalism specifically. When exactly? Obviously, if you are a modernist, you're probably sticking firmly to your guns that nationalism is a modern invention and an anachronism until at least the 18th century. But alternative views are available. And in this argument, of course, it is the 16th century that is pivotal. Here is the century that saw the break with Rome, the growth of Protestantism as a definer of Englishness, the loss of the last lands in France as Calais finally falls, and Edward III and Philippa thrash in their tombs in fury and despair, the Spanish Armada, survival in the face of overwhelming force, and the exploration overseas, if that's the right word, piracy, as it's known by others, the spread of the printing press, the growth of the political classes, though maybe that really only gets exciting with the mad political debate of the Civil War. So it's much easier to construct a powerful argument for nationalism in the early modern period. But, ladies and gentlemen, there are historians braver than this. There are some who gather together in quiet places that will argue that by the late 9th and 10th centuries, many of the elements are already in place. After all, this is when Alfred started talking consciously of the English as one entity, the Angulkun. Here is a man who sought specifically to promote the use of English as a language, who led a nation confronted with an existential external threat. Always a good thing as far as promoting unity is concerned. That promotes the church in England as a national concern, who reforms law codes to try and create one central collection. Alfred's successors, particularly Edgar the Peaceable, for example, can probably make stronger claims as England's government becomes yet more clearly centralised, well in advance of most other European kingdoms. And it's a fair argument. Counter-arguments there are, of course, in spades, so counter-arguments might be the strength of the international church and the obedience of the English church to that church at this time. The shallowness of both the political community and those who could read. It is quite impossible at this time to have any confidence in the involvement of anything other than the nobility in such a political community. It might be that the average churl on the Clopperham omnibus did indeed feel English to the core, but it is just impossible to know. Most conclude that the regional loyalties and identities of those old kingdoms, Mercia, East Anglia, Northumbria, Wessex, remained too strong to convincingly claim a true sense of pan-English national identity. Then, of course, the Norman conquest throws all the cards up into the air. How quickly did those invaders consider themselves to be English? Can there really be a strong English identity in a period of cross-channel empires, and a strong pan-European elite that shared the same chivalric code, fought and jousted together, and slaughtered peasants in the same habitual manner? There is then the question of the English language, a language that had British words in it. Then we'd had Old English. Then the Danes came along and messed that up. Now we have more than one language in the same kingdom. Surely that has to mess things up for the nationalist argument. But against that, there are those chronicles by the likes of William of Malmesbury and Henry of Huntingdon. They display bags of recognition of English identity, as I have already quoted. And actually the general agreement now is that within a couple of generations, those Norman invaders are assimilated. Well, that is to say, they feel distinctively English. I am struck by William the Marshal. So yes, he was clearly part of a coherent international elite as he travelled round the tournament circuit, knocking seven bells out of people. But he also complained of being mocked as being English, and therefore a little weird by the French. The next event that claims everyone's attention is the loss of Normandy in 1204, when some of those divisions are, of course, brutally removed. But although cross-channel land ownership is removed, the English don't stop hankering officially after Normandy until the disastrously incompetent Treaty of Paris in 1259. And there's still Gascony over there, of course. Henry III and his Savoyard aliens is an interesting piece of the puzzle. You might or might not remember that Henry III brings in many friends of his wife. All that talk of aliens suggests a sense of English self from which they are different. But it's equally easy to interpret that in terms of simply court factions. The Savoyard were part of one faction, the English were part of another one. After that, of course, we come to the Hundred Years' War. This has become seen as a turning point, a time when England's opposition to France forced her to define herself more clearly, when English became officially promoted as the language of law and government, a time also when the demands of war created centralised institutions and the end to the purely feudal army towards one of national recruitment and management. And then, of course, at the same time is the growth in vernacular literature in Chaucer and a slightly rabidly English poet called Lawrence Minot. Though it seems slightly counterintuitive to hold up the Hundred Years' War as the key moment of English nationalism when the whole point was to win the throne of France, it's also interesting that, of course, Henry V was accepted as king by a reasonable part of France, which seems to suggest the supremacy of those old dynastic principles rather than national loyalties. So there we are, some key milestones in English history towards the 1500 point. Alfred and his English cakes, the conquest and the post-colonial society, the loss of Normandy, the Hundred Years' War. In the next episode, we're going to discuss where that left us in 1500 in terms of an English national consciousness. Does this all amount to a recognisably English nation with a shared sense of what that means? I suppose I should say have a good week and all the rest of it, but in fact, you're going to have the second bit immediately, so I won't say any of that. I'll just say see you in the next episode.